Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 11, Fine Threads with Lillian Whipple. This episode, we have stories of fine threads. Some threads are gossamer fine, like those used by amazing weaver Lillian Whipple, who works in silk finer than most of us can even see. Some threads are made fine and meaningful by their stories and the fact that they were collected from all over the globe to be woven into a project to heal the planet. The holidays are upon us, and whichever holidays you celebrate, Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, Yule, whatever, happy holidays. In the news this week, we have a couple more listener donations from Angela and Mary Beth. Thank you. On January 17th, I'll be doing a demo of rigid heddle weaving. It's going to be held at the Weaving Works, and I will have both an Ashford Knitter's loom and a new portable rigid heddle loom from Schott called Flip. Even though it's a demo, you will get hands-on experience with both looms, and it's a great way to get a taste of weaving. If you are in the Seattle area, please give Weaving Works a call to register for that demonstration. The audio comment line is having some technical difficulties. Comments are apparently being recorded, but I am unable to download them. I've spoken to the audio tech support, and they admitted it's a known bug and are working on it, but at this time, I am still not able to get your audio comments, so I'm going to disable that. And if you'd like to respond to the show, please either email me an MP3 or use the telephone call-in number instead. Another brief technical note, the download problem on the site has been fixed, so now, no matter what browser you're using, if you click on the download episode link, the file will download to your machine instead of starting streaming. And this should solve a lot of problems that folks have been having. So thank you, Network Solutions, for helping me change my directory headers. There was some talk on the online lists about providing transcripts of Weavecast episodes for weavers who are hearing impaired or who are unable to download episodes. And I think it's a great idea. I don't have funds at the moment to pay for transcription. Transcription in my area runs about $20 an hour, and at 4 to 5 hours to transcribe a show, you can see that gets really expensive really fast. I did have one wonderful lady volunteer to do a trial transcript. She's asked to remain anonymous. She took episode 10 and created a transcript from it. And we're going to see what the response is, whether people really like that, whether people are utilizing it. If there is a big demand for transcripts, I will see if I can figure out a way to make it work. If you are a retired transcriptionist who would love to help out a worthy cause, please do give me an email at syne@weavecast.com. In the meantime, you can go up to the show notes for episode 10, and right under the download episode 10 link, there is a link that says download the transcript. I've got a great idea. Something I've been doing, it's just been a ton of fun. I had a pile of those cardboard cones that yarn comes on. And I'm such a pack rat that whenever I would use up all the yarn on a cone, I would keep the little cardboard cone. And occasionally I found them useful for weeding broken warp threads, but I had way more than I needed. So I went down to my son's preschool and I said, hey, I have these cones that would be great to paint for art projects. Would you like some? And the response has been enthusiastic. Anyone who takes care of small children can use all the help they can get. So I encourage you, if you have cardboard cones piling up and you don't know what to do with them, please consider donating them to some group that has small children who need to be entertained. It's good press for weaving and gives you more space in your studio for new yarn. We had a call in from Nadine Saunders. She is the singing weaver, and her group Straw into Gold was featured on episode 2.
Hi, Sign. This is Nadine Saunders. Every episode, you just keep getting better and better. Last week, I listened to a whole bunch of episodes. Episode 4, Mary Zickafoose. I worked for Mary when I was in art school. I learned to warp and did some weaving for her. I learned things in your interview that I didn't even know about Mary, so that was really great. Time to weave. I was laughing because I was multitasking as I was listening to all these episodes. My favorite episode is the Black Sheep Gathering. That was a wonderful episode, and I know you were worried about sound, but it was just great. Good to hear Russell. I had interviewed him when he was retiring and wrote an article for the newspaper. And there again, I heard some of the same stories, but I heard some new stories. So you just keep bringing these people back into my life. It's fun to know more. Anyway, I just wanted to say I think it's wonderful because that's what I'm interested in, is the people involved in doing this. Technique is great. Materials are fine. But those are not the things that draw me, the connection with the people. I look forward to listening to the next episodes as I try to get some weaving done. Thanks again, and do know that people are listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Nadine, for that great comment. For me, WeaveCast is all about the stories, too, so I'm glad you're enjoying the show, and thank you for permission to play some of your wonderful Straw into Gold songs. We've got another one coming up later on. Coming up next, we have Terry Helwig, who spearheaded an international initiative called the One Thread Project. It's created some really amazing work. I'm just delighted that she could talk to us. And I'd like to thank Sue, who sent me a link to Terry's website and suggested she might be a fun person to have on the show. With us here today is Terry Helwig of The Thread Project. And if you haven't heard about this, this is a really amazing global initiative to create weavings that bring together threads from all over the world into an amazing display. So welcome, Terry.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Now, can you describe the project a little bit and what inspired it?
This project was really a response to 9/11. The night of 9/11, I imagine thousands of people like me lying awake in the darkness, despairing that the world seemed to be hanging by a thread. And I know I was feeling so powerless and wondering how can my one tattered thread of hope matter in this world, because, you know, I'm only one. And then I was thinking about that thread and then how each of us enters the world threaded to our mother, mm-hmm. and how DNA is called the thread of life. And I thought, you know, maybe a thread is no small thing. And I began to imagine actual threads collected from people around the world and weaving those threads together and thinking, you know, maybe they could symbolize the mending of our world and the weaving together of our humanity. So I spent the next 5 years collecting individual threads from tens of thousands of people from over 70 countries. Then I found 49 weavers that have set up looms around the world to weave those threads into panels of cloth.
Well, that's amazing. That sounds like a very large-scale project. How did you connect with people to get threads, and how did you connect with weavers to put together the cloth?
If I had known what this project would entail when I started, I might not have begun. So ignorance is bliss. There's this philosophy that 6 degrees of separation, mm-hmm. And that is that whatever it is that we want or need to be in contact with, that through six people that you can usually find what you want. I'm not a weaver, and mm-hmm. so I say ideas often come to the willing instead of the qualified. I just started asking my friends if anybody knew a weaver, and then we found weavers, and then they would know a weaver that was maybe in another country. And it took us a long time, let's say, to get a weaver from Africa. It took me 2 years, but then I found three of them there. And the threads came the same way. I would tell my friends, and they would tell their friends, and I put together a website, www.threadproject.com, and people began forwarding this on to their friends, and threads started coming in from all over. I also had something that was called thread ambassadors.
And
those people would just go into their community and collect threads for me, and they would go into schools and churches and their women's groups that met and communities, and they would collect threads.
Very cool. Now, I'm curious, as a non-weaver, why did you choose weaving cloth as your medium for this project?
Well, you know, it really seemed like the threads chose me. I didn't think about doing an art project or anything. It's just like this idea was placed before me, and it was like, do you want to run with it or not? And as I said, I didn't feel like I was qualified to do this, but the idea was so strong that I just felt I had the resources to be able to go out and get the weavers I needed. But I do love symbolism and metaphor, and to me the symbolism of thread and cloth is all about community and unity. The thought of wrapping ourselves in a world cloth was very inspiring to me.
Well, it's a gorgeous project, and I'm really glad that you took it and ran with it. Do you have any other experience putting together projects of this magnitude?
No.
No, this just came out of the blue.
It did. It came out of the blue, and I have to say, it's been a full-time job for the last 5 years. So nobody was more surprised by this than I was.
What are some of the interesting things that got woven into the cloth?
People began to send in stories along with the fibers, and this is the heart of the project for me. The beating heart of the project are the stories and the letters that people would send in with their different fibers. I have some letters here and some excerpts of what people have said of some of the fibers they sent in, and I would like to share just a couple of them.
That would be lovely.
Okay. It took me a long time to find a thread from Antarctica. And again, it was a friend of a friend of a friend, but I received a letter from a woman named Nancy. And she said, I've enclosed a flag marker from Antarctica. It was flown and shredded in the southern wind.
Wow.
It was attached to bamboo poles. And she said that these flags mark the safe trails and dangerous crevices in Antarctica. Another woman named Rebecca sent in a strip of fabric that was woven by lepers from one of Mother Teresa's leper colonies outside of Calcutta.
Oh, amazing.
And she said, if people who have no fingers or toes can learn to weave, any of us can learn whatever we must to make it through. We have some threads from 9/11 families. We have a thread that was found on the killing fields in Cambodia. You know, we have some unusual things, like we have a thread that was spun from otter fur that was shed on the dock of an oyster farm in Alaska.
Oh, wow.
One letter made me laugh. This woman named Jeanette wrote in, and she said, this ribbon has been on the back of my bedroom door to attract a mate into my life. It was part of feng shui, and she says, it does not seem to be working. So she sent that to us. And then we have some threads that were dyed with Kool-Aid by third and fourth graders. One dear letter came from a little girl, and she says, this is a piece of towel that my best friend, my guinea pig, laid on as he died.
Aww.
And so I have four notebooks of letters, just 1,000 letters that people have sent in with their threads. And to me, that was my reward as I went through this project, to receive these bits and pieces of people's lives.
What's amazing is how it really shows the scope of humanity. I mean, from very strong, powerful things to the everyday, to humorous things.
Yes, just, it was. They made me laugh, and they made me cry, and they made me think.
Yeah.
So all of that was included.
So if people like me wanted to go view this. Where is this work showing?
This summer, it was at the United Nations, three of our panels. For a few more days, it's going to still be at St. Paul's Chapel in New York City, across from Ground Zero. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to be working on an exhibit that's going to be in the City Gallery in Charleston, South Carolina. And that's going to be put up September 8th to October 28th of 2007.
Oh, okay.
So we're looking long range out there. And then in 2008, in the state of Pennsylvania, they're going to be taking, there are seven claws, mm-hmm. and seven different schools will be hanging one cloth in each of their schools as a community-wide project.
So did you do one cloth for each continent?
Yes.
That was your thought?
The idea is seven is a very important number to this project because seven is the number of wholeness and completion. And so we have the seven continents, which make one world, and we have the seven colors of the color spectrum, which make one light, mm-hmm. 7 days of a week that make one week. And so that was important that we made one cloth for each of the continents. And each of them are a different color of the color spectrum.
Oh, very interesting. I hadn't realized that.
Yeah.
Very cool. So what's next for you now that this project has kind of reached fulfillment?
I'm looking for an organization or an institution that will travel these cloths and use them to promote tolerance and compassionate community because I don't believe that these cloths belong to me. I feel like I've only been a keeper of the threads. So I'll still be putting my time towards finding a perfect home for these cloths to live. And then currently I'm writing a performance piece to travel along with these cloths, and the idea is to bring to life some of the stories and threads that have been donated to the Thread Project. So that's going to keep me busy for a good while. And everybody keeps saying, this would be a great book. So I may look at that later on.
It would. It would indeed. What were you doing before you started this project?
My master's degree is in counseling psychology.
Oh.
And I have always considered myself a cheerleader of the human spirit. I was leading workshops and leading trips to different places in Europe, but it was really with a bent of personal growth and development.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this idea came to me, it kind of, it just took over. It just grabbed me, and I felt like I had to follow it. So I've put everything else on the back burner for a while.
Wow. Well, like I said, the work is stunning, and the stories that you've told are amazing. I read on your website that you spread the weaving out over 49 weavers, but that you had the same weaver who began the work in the work. Why did you choose to do that?
Well, our first weaver was Judith Crone, and she became the weaving consultant of the Thread Project. When any weaver would ask me a question, I would have no idea what they were talking about, and I would go to Judith and say, what should I say? Judith was instrumental in answering all of our weaving questions. And when she said she would like to weave the first panel, she said, I have only one request. And I said, well, what's that? And she said that I would also get to weave the last panel. And that sounded so full circle to me. And what's really special about that to me is that Judith took the shuttle. And I was with her both when she wove the first panel and the last panel. A group of women gathered. And the shuttle that she used for the first stitch, she also used for it the last stitch. And then she asked if she could insert that wooden shuttle into the bottom of the last panel. And it is there and can be viewed.
So what was that like, finishing up the weaving of this huge multi-year project?
It was very much like giving birth, having this work completed, and there's really an energy, I feel like, in these cloths. I know so many of the stories that are in it. Sometimes I can look at a thread and know what story that goes with it, And it truly feels like, to me, a tapestry of humanity. I think it has to be one of the most diverse cloths ever woven. It was very humbling to be in the presence of these cloths. I have something that the weaver Judith Crone wrote to me about the experience of weaving on one of the panels, and I would love to read that.
Oh, please do.
Okay. She said, "When everyone left, I sat at the loom alone and finished weaving the panel. The candles were still lit. The house was very quiet. The rhythm of life is so like a loom, a beat, a pulse, a memory. The stories were reflected in this amazing cloth. I stretched it out to see the magic that had exploded on the loom. The joined threads created beautiful harmony. The cloth represents all of us, diverse, beautiful, simple, and strong."
That's lovely.
Well, thank you.
And if you want to view images of this project, please go up to the web and check out www.threadproject.com. There will be a link to this in the show notes. And thank you, Terry, so much for talking to us and telling us about your work.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Coming up next, we have an interview with Lillian Whipple, who is a personal hero of mine and who is known for working in extraordinarily fine silk threads. I'm very delighted to have her on the show.
So here we are with Lillian Whipple, and she specializes in just exquisite fine thread weaving. I was very lucky to hear her talk in Tacoma a couple of years ago and was just very impressed, and actually owns several of her little tapestry-like creations. So Lillian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So I'm always curious. Hand weaving is such an unusual profession. How did you get started?
I was looking for another hobby. Which sounds funny. I've been knitting for a long time, and I tried a lot of other kinds of activities. My children were getting a little bit older, and I was debating about taking up quilting or candle making, and a friend of mine who made candles showed me some weaving a friend of hers had done. Mm-hmm. And I said, "You know, I've always been interested in weaving." And she said, "Well, she has a small loom she puts in her closet," which is a real joke when you realize how much equipment she actually has.
Yeah.
I was fascinated, and she said, "Well, there's a class being offered at the YWCA in Stonestown in San Francisco," and I ended up taking it with several friends, including her. But it wasn't what I was looking for, because I wanted a loom, and this was off loom. And the instructor told me there was class in the Sunset District in a church, but that's all she knew. I went looking and finally called the Yarn Depot in San Francisco, and they put me in touch with Millie Ayers, who ran this. They called themselves Sunset Weavers. They met on Tuesdays. So the first Tuesday I went was somewhere in September of 71, and I dropped my daughter off at kindergarten and my two-year-old son off with a good friend who had a two-year-old son.
Uh-huh.
And I showed up at Sunset Weavers with a box of leftover knitting yarn, and I've never looked back. They provided the instructors, the looms, the library, and tea and coffee. Just had to bring your own lunch and your own yarn for $1 a week.
Oh, wow.
What? Only on Tuesdays.
Sounds wonderful.
So what? I became really hooked, and that's where I got started.
What took you from knitting yarns to super fine 140/2 silk?
Well, apparently how fine it was never really fazed me as far as that went. At Sunset Weavers, I met two ladies, Joanne Walsh and Kristen Barrere, who were dyers, and they bought silk to dye, and I became a very good customer of theirs. And at one time, they had some 240/2 silk chappie.
240?
Yes, and this
is
the primary warp I use now. But at that time, Kristen showed it to me, and I said, "No way." So they actually tried to, because it was 2-pound cones, and I think there's like, I don't know, 56,000 miles or something in a cone.
Oh, wow.
In that much yardage. Anyway, they tried to package it in smaller quantities, and the machinery just wouldn't handle it because of the static electricity that silk creates. So they had some tubes that weren't really great. They had some bubbles and breaks and, I want to say, grease on them. And so Kristen said, well, I'll give these to you practically. I think I paid her something. And then I sat on them for a while. I like to quote Diane Babeck, who said, we age them like fine wine. And I think all of us must do that. So I probably had them for a year. And I did meet Diane Babeck, and she encouraged me. My guild was asked to weave bookmarks. Diane told me to go ahead and put this fine silk on as bookmarks, and an inch and a half is not a big deal. You can do it at 90 yens per inch. And I wove these bookmarks, and they were just so neat. And people said, wow. And I thought, well, okay. And at that point, I had my own business doing dressmaking and alterations, so I figured, okay, I was going to weave a blouse. Well, what I found out was you need to really refine your skills for the blouse. But I'm one of these who refuses to give up. And I managed to do it, but I sure made a lot of mistakes. And what I did learn is, you really need to have a system to do it, and that's what I refined. And I found that it was really satisfying to go to the fine threads, and I think it was in 1987 that I heard a speech by Walter Nottingham, spoke in Southern California, and I would not recognize the man today, but I do remember his name. What I got out of his speech was, if you really want to become proficient in something, you need to focus on it. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to do everything. And I thought, what I really like are the fine threads. And so that's where my focus went. And finally, my husband said, what are you doing with all this other stuff? So I pretty well only have fine silk anymore. That's become my real focus.
Very cool. So what structure did you weave those original bookmarks in? I'm just curious.
It's actually not technically satin, but it was broken turn twill. They were 4 ends per block and doing a 1-3 broken twill.
Sounds lovely.
So the first bookmarks were, and the blouse were both on 12 shafts, so I had 3 blocks.
So what changed between weaving an inch and a half width to blouse width material? What sort of challenges did you encounter?
Mainly the beaming and the fact that I didn't have a fine enough reed.
Oh.
It's interesting. You can do many things in a narrow width, and I encourage people to begin with a narrower project and then work wide. But when you start multiplying the width, you multiply your problems. So if you haven't beamed it correctly, you're dealing with a lot more ends. And really, I have found one of the keys is being able to beam it well. If I can beam it, I can weave it. But there have been several warps I haven't been able to beam. And I've taken them and thrown them away because they weren't strong enough to beam.
Ah.
And therefore, I couldn't beam them well enough to get them even on the loom. So the finest stuff that I've been able to beam, I've been able to weave. So that seems to be the criteria. I use a warping mill, and then I transfer it to a warping drum, and then I use a beam winder, and by the time then I've got it on the beam, I'm ready. I thread from the back to the front.
So when you're transferring it from the warping mill, is that just like a traditional warping mill?
Mine happens to be horizontal.
Okay.
And it would work the same way from a vertical.
And so then you put it on a drum, so you're keeping the threads under tension the whole time?
Exactly.
Ah.
There are two articles that I've seen about a warping drum. One of them is Peggy Osterkamp.
Uh-huh.
She has it written up in one of her books. And the other one is Sue Butler, and she has a book out on weaving with rayon chenille. And she has also highlighted the drum. She has the same model that I do.
I recently wove, I was feeling really good, to weave with 140 over 2 silk. I didn't even know 240 existed. One of the things I did was I kept it under tension using the new AVL warping wheel.
Mm-hmm. That works well, too.
Have you played with one of those?
No, I haven't. Somebody brought it to one of my classes and demonstrated it, but I haven't gone that direction because I have the other equipment.
Sure, sure.
But I believe the warping mill is a good way to go.
Now, you mentioned that static electricity is a problem because, you know, silk does generate static as you're winding bobbins and as you're winding warp. How have you dealt with that?
The only problem I seem to have with it now is if it's in the weft and I'm throwing a fly shuttle. I actually have a special shuttle. It's a gated shuttle is the technical term for it. I think they call it a pigtail and post or something. But there's a spring in there that's a coiled spring, and you have the option of how many little pegs you want to go around. It's been used in the mill. That tension on the fine weft controls the static as it goes in and flies across the loom.
Cool.
Because that's when you create the static.
I was winding the weft for my little bookmarks, and my 3-year-old thought it was funny because we'd turn out the lights and then I'd shock him with it.
Oh! I hadn't thought about that. I used to pay my grandson $1 a spool to wind the spools for me so I could put them on the mill.
That's great. One of the things you're noted for are these exquisite little tiny images of like kimonos and butterflies that are kind of 2 inches by 2 inches high. Now, I can't figure out if those are tapestry or weft inlay. How do you actually make those?
Neither one. They're actually loom controlled. I found that I'm very pictorial in my weaving.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, when I started weaving, it was a two-shaft loom. And so I did a bit of inlay, and I did some tapestry, and I found that's not really my forte. I'm not really comfortable with it, but I like the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, when I was first learning to weave, I went through Mary Black's New Key to Weaving, and I think I must have read it cover to cover, and I discovered Summer and Winter. And my favorite weaving teacher was Frances McSweeney. She didn't like Summer and Winter. She liked Crackle, because Crackle was not as definite. It didn't have the definition. It was more mottled. And Madeline Vanderhoot, she prefers Double Weave because it's cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the extremes between how clear you want your image. I found that the Summer and Winter worked for me. I was a member of Loom and Shuttle Guild in San Francisco and part of their Ahornist study group. And one year, each year, we'd take a different subject. And one year I said, well, I was really interested in Summer and Winter. So they said they were too. Could I please teach it? And I must say that when I teach something, I know it probably better than the students. How else can you teach it?
I imagine.
So I found that was a really successful year for me. And that was 76 to 77 that I taught this particular study group. And later, I think it was about 1986, 87, I was looking for a way to weave the Lone Cypress, which is a symbol for me that's in the Monterey area.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing our conference, and that was the symbol. And I remembered that you could do the imagery in Summer and Winter. So I went back to that, and I did it on this 240/2 silk. So, I mean, the piece came out to be maybe an inch and a half wide
yeah.
as a strip. And it really was quite successful, and I then happened to find a birthday card that had a butterfly on it that was actually done as an embossed design as though it was filigree lace, which are little blocks.
Ooh.
So I'm standing in the drugstore counting the blocks, and the blocks were, I believe it was 13. And at that time I had 16 shafts, and in Summer and Winter you only have to dedicate 2 shafts to the tie-downs, and the rest are all pattern blocks. So I had 14 pattern blocks with, and I thought, I can weave this.
Very cool.
So I took the profile right off the card and started in with the butterfly, bought a butterfly book and created 2 more. And then my sister said, well, she was interested in iris, so I created an iris. And Margaret Copeland said, well, if you're doing iris and butterflies, how about insects? So she designed 4 insects, did a print screen, and handed them off, and I wove insects. So here I was, weaving this stuff and finding that people really kind of said, wow, which was like, oh, this is fun. And so the original butterflies were just like maybe an inch on the loom. And then when I did the iris, I found I wanted to do 3 across, so I just spaced them out and ended up with 3, and then I think I put a selvage on the part of it. And then I started finding that I could glue them and cut them apart.
Oh.
And I have continued with that. So that I actually, when I weave one of those little pieces, I'm actually weaving 12, usually.
Oh, that sounds like a good way to do it.
Well, so it becomes production weaving. So I have basically the same profile set up, but it's become finer. I've now up to 24 shafts, and it's called tacate. It's a summer and winter threading, and it's the same structure that Jason Collingwood weaves his rugs and Michael Rohde weaves his rugs. Michael Rohde has a 4-end block. Jason Collingwood has a 3-end block, and Lillian Whipple has a 2-end block.
Oh, cool.
So it's the same structure that these other men are doing. One of the classes I was teaching in Florida, Jason was on the other side of the hall from me, and I think the first morning we had a break, he came over and he said, what are you teaching? And I looked at him, and we talked about it. I said, yeah, it's the same structure that you weave, except he uses a 1 pattern 2, and I use 1 pattern 2 second pattern. So that it changes.
Yeah, it's amazing how much of a difference scale makes.
Very much so.
In all of this. Mm-hmm. So I have Lillian Whipple, fine thread expert, and I have to ask you a question.
Sure.
My bookmarks. The pattern weft is 60/2 silk, and it's too thick to weave back in. Is it okay to just glue it and snip it off near the selvage?
Mm-hmm.
Is that acceptable?
Actually, that's why I use the fringes, because then I can put the knot in the space.
Ah.
And my selvages are absolutely hideous. because when it tends to pull in because it's so weft-faced.
Gotcha. Okay.
For my structure.
I was doing overshot, so the the pattern weft is so much thicker than the ground weft. And, you know, it's like you can't hide it in the fringe.
No, you can't. And so you probably could just trim it off. And if it's woven tightly enough, you wouldn't have a problem with it anyway. Well, and the other thing is with fine threads, there's a lot that you can hide. I find I tie a lot of knots, and then when I get to a heavier thread, it's like, oh, my gosh, I can't tie the knot when it went through the warp and the handles and everything.
Well, that was one thing I loved about my experiments in fine thread weaving, is it's like there are mistakes, but they are so small, nobody will ever see them.
That's true. They're there, but they're minimized.
Right. What advice would you give weavers who are thinking about fine threads but haven't quite taken the plunge yet?
I find that small steps work best. So if you're going to go with something finer, don't jump, you know, from like rug warp to really fine spider stuff. But take it a step at a time, go a little finer, and use the same structure you're familiar with. Mm. Don't change everything at once. Just change one thing. And the narrower, the easier it is to control. The wider it is, you have more to deal with. And sometimes it's even harder to get a clean shed if it's really, really dense. It acts denser because of the width.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense, because all the friction would be multiplied.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you currently working on?
I'm weaving yoga mats.
Really?
Yes.
How cool is that?
I do yoga once a week with an instructor. In fact, it's about a two-hour workout, and then I come home and sleep for three. But she's keeping me in shape, and I figure it's worth it. So I read someplace that people were weaving yoga mats, and they were using things like summer and winter, and I don't remember what else. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to do that. And then I decided, I'm going to do that. So then I had to figure it all out. Well, I've recently been doing rep weave using 62 silk. I did a couple of garments, and they came out very well. So this time I decided I was going to do the yoga mats with this same rep weave. One of it's 62. The other is something on my shelf labeled natural silk or spun silk. I don't know. But it's the contrast that I needed for the rep weave. Are you familiar with rep weave?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So I'm doing that, but I didn't know what to use for the padding. I asked my weaving friends and anybody who I could tag. And what I'm ending up using, and I've just started weaving it yesterday, so I'm not sure how well it's going to work, but is the fleece blanket stuff that you buy in the yardage store.
Oh, interesting. So is this a yoga mat that you put on top of one of those sticky mats, or is it replacing the sticky mat?
I think I'm going to use it as both.
Oh.
I'm not sure yet. As I say, I've just started weaving it. I just got it beamed the other day. I didn't beam it as well as I usually do, and I'm not sure if I might have tension problems. I think I'm going to end up doing one mat, cutting it off, retying, and such. I'm doing four different colors, and the colors in the warp are multiple. One layer is multiple colors, and the other one is this natural color. And I asked my sister, who also does yoga, and she's one of these, she either likes it or she doesn't. And I said, okay, I want to weave you a yoga mat. She said, oh, fantastic. And I said, all right, what kind of a design? She said, I want my name in the lower right corner, period. That's it. So each one of us is getting just the name. And for me, with all the patterning I do, to put in one pattern on one corner is kind of like, oh, my gosh, that's if it's going to be plain weave. But it's really moving fast. So I'm cutting this blanket in like one-inch strips.
Uh-huh.
What I did was by the ends of the bolts, and I don't know, there's 2 or 3 yards on each bolt, and I'm cutting it from the length along and then putting it on a rug shuttle.
Oh, cool.
And then throwing as the alternate weft, throwing a 62 silk.
Well, it sounds lovely.
So far, I've gotten part of my name in it. I figured I'd better start with mine.
Well, how are you going to deal with all that plain weave, though, after doing pattern for years and years?
Well,
I guess
there's a lot of books on tape you can listen to.
And podcasts, too, I hear.
Yes, I understand that's an option. Madeline Vanderhoot gives a program, What Kind of a Weaver Are You? Color and Texture, or Are You Loom Controlled? And she takes one of my iris as her example of extreme loom control because that's exactly where I am. And I plot it all out, and then I program the computer, and off I go. I love what I can do. And Gray, my husband, actually was there when I took a class on a jacquard-type loom.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you want one of those? But I said, no, I really don't want one of those because what I do on my loom, I can also do what I call a treadle pickup and get almost anything I want.
Yeah, I've heard the jacquard looms are quite big.
They are big, although mine is big too. But the other thing is that I found that if you really want finer threads, you have to put more boxes behind each other to get the set. And because there's such a really big job to thread, I don't think I'd change them very often. Although it may take me 6 months to get one of these fine warps off, I will probably rethread it several times. So anyway, this is my comfort level. Okay. I've had this loom for since 1993.
And is it an AVL?
It's an AVL 24 shaft Comp Kidabi.
Oh, cool.
And they've tried to get me to move up to, you know, 40 shafts, and I said, I like what I got. Right. And then my software failed, and I had to go to a new software program, and that really threw me.
Yeah, that can be hard once you've learned all the techniques and shortcuts for one to switch to the other.
So it was a pretty steep learning curve. My husband kept saying, it's flat, and I said, well, I feel it's steep because I have to learn all this stuff. But I've adjusted. I'm still weaving, and I'm still loving it. It's when I can't do it anymore and I'm not enjoying it that I might not continue, but it's not at this point.
Very, very cool. Well, I'm really glad you picked up weaving instead of quilting.
I am too. I really love this. And it's not as portable as quilting might be, but it's my second life. I just love it.
Cool.
Thank you for your interview.
Thank you.
Coming up, we have today's swatch, in which I'll describe weaving with really fine threads. And we've got a new theme for the today's swatch segment. It's a song I found on the Podsafe Music Network that is composed entirely of sound tests. It's amazingly funny. I listened to this thing 6 times and it makes me smile every time. And after I listened to it, I realized that when I weave a test swatch, it is very much like doing an audio check. It seemed an appropriate theme song for Swatch of the Day. Without further ado, here is a snippet of Testing 1-2-3 by Stark Effect.
This is a test. And I would be so grateful if we could make this test work. Now, I don't have any idea whatsoever in terms of how in the world this is supposed to work.
In today's swatch, I tackle one of my fears head on. I started weaving with 1450 yards per pound rayon chenille, which is pretty thick stuff. And then I went on to 3-2 pearl cotton and 5-2 pearl cotton. And I toyed around with 10-2 pearl cotton and kind of got in a rut. Then I went and heard Lillian Whipple speak. And she passed around samples of some of the amazing things that she's woven. Ultra fine little patterns in gossamer silk. And I was just entranced. And Lillian kept saying things like, weaving fine is just like regular weaving, you know, with a few technical details to work out. And it's not that big a deal. And I can do it. You could do it. I left Lillian Whipple's talk and immediately ran into Robin and Russ's table where he had 140/2 silk. He had it in navy and mint green and pink and some 120/2 silk in a natural color. And I succumbed. I was so inspired by Lillian Whipple's talk that I bought one of each. Probably enough to last me the rest of my life. Because the thing about fine threads is one cone goes a really long ways. But anyway, I bought this stuff in a burst of enthusiasm, and I was so happy and so excited. And I went home. I looked at that spool of super fine silk that was thinner than my hair. And I freaked. I put it in a bag. And I put it in my stash. I wrote fine silk on a plastic box. And I put it in the garage. And there it stayed. 4 years. Every once in a while I would pick it up and I would pet the cone and I would go, oh, it's so soft. And I would imagine the things that I could weave with it. But then I would start to pull an individual thread off the cone and I could barely see it. And I'd go, maybe next project. And back into the plastic box it would go. But then finally, I was at a mentoring week with Judith McKenzie. I said, Judith, do you think I could weave 140 over 2 silk? And she looked at me and she said, Sign, weaving fine is just weaving. So two great weavers had told me I could do this. With some wonderful advice from Judith, I started to tackle the project. I would learn how to weave fine threads, and I grabbed up that 140 over 2 silk. I had had much the same idea that Lillian Whipple did. I thought, well, why don't I start with bookmarks? Because if I'm weaving and it turns into a complete hairball and I have to cut it off the loom, better it should be a warp that's only an inch and a half wide than a warp that's 36 inches wide, if you know what I mean. I wound my 140 over 2 silk. I did cheat and use an AVL warping wheel because that kept the threads under tension the entire time. If you're going to try to warp this silk and you didn't have something like Lillian Whipple's drum or an AVL warping wheel, I would highly recommend using Peggy Osterkamp's method of keeping the threads under tension with a kite stick. A really talented weaver could probably chain off a warp in superfine silk and make it work, but not me. So I used my AVL warping wheel. I warped up an inch and a half of 140 over 2 silk at 72 ends per inch, so 6 per dent and a 12 dent reed. The beaming on went really well. I did back to front, obviously. For a thread this fine, it would be hard on it to warp front to back. Again, a really talented weaver could probably make it work, but I didn't want to try, so I warped back to front. Then threading it was really not as hard as I imagined it would be. I was thinking that I would never see the super fine stuff and I would get completely flustered. But it turns out the threading cross made it really easy. Sure, sometimes I could barely see the threads, but if I could pluck the next one in the line, I could, you know, how you kind of wiggle a thread back and forth to figure out which one is next in the cross and the one that comes free is the one that's next? Well, I used that. After a while, threading this stuff seemed very normal. You do acclimate pretty quickly. I got it on. My first attempt, I used split metal heddles, which cut the threads. It was very frustrating. So I beamed everything back onto the back beam, bought some TechSolve heddles, and I didn't even take the split metal heddles off the shafts. I just put the TechSolve into the middle. And then when I rethreaded, the weaving was wonderful. So I don't know if it's that mine were a little bit sharp. You could probably get by with inserted eye heddles, but TechSolve worked brilliantly with this super fine silk. And I have to say that once I got that little bit straightened out, weaving with fine silk was a joy. It was surprisingly a joy. I mean, it went slow, because your weft is small, so you had to take pleasure in very tiny things. But the cloth was so fine that it was just a delight. One problem I did run into, and Lillian touches on this a bit in her interview, was that because I was threading 6 per dent and a 12 dent reed to get my 72 ends per inch, there were reed marks. This happens because the actual metal wire of the reed is so much thicker than the individual threads that after I had woven some plain weave cloth, there were these little stripes. Effectively, what my reed had done was crammed and spaced, because where the threads were together was very tightly spaced, and then there was this gap where the reed wire was. You could design your project to have this pinstriping effect, or you could go out and find a finer reed, or you could weave something that obscured the reed marks. Like I noticed if I did a weft-faced twill, you didn't notice the reed marks. Or if I used a heavier weft, like if I used a 60 over 2 weft, it was only when I was using 140 over 2 in the weft and the warp that the reed marks really stood out for me. So it would be something to play around with. Another joy of weaving fine is you can go to a fabric store and get really cool wefts. I went to my local fabric store and I found what they call embroidery threads. machine embroiderers are demanding some really wicked cool threads these days. They have threads that shift color, like painted yarns do. They had glow-in-the-dark threads, which would be very cool for a Halloween project. They had holo shimmer, which is a very glitzy plastic thread that shimmers, and it comes in a rainbow of colors. They had tons of colors for all the different sewing threads. So when you weave fine, a whole world opens up to you in what you can choose and play around with. So if you haven't woven something insanely fine, I'd encourage you to go out and get some TechSolve heddles. And if you're not familiar with what I mean by TechSolve heddles, I mean, they're basically string heddles, but made out of a nylon that's already got the eye done in the center, so all you do is slide them on. You could also make your very own string heddles if you were much more industrious than I am. Get some heddles that'll work with fine threads. Go find the finest thread in your stash. And perhaps it's like my thread and has been properly aged for a while. And take pity on that thread and plan a project with it. Don't let it molder in your stash forever. And if you start with something thin like a bookmark and it goes hideously awry, it's easy to cut off. That's my story of how I got over my fear of fine thread weaving. Though I must admit that hearing Lillian Whipple mention 220 over 2 silk has me a little scared. I'm going to have to go out and find some and try it. Oh, it's probably a little bit more insight into my psyche than you needed. Do not be afraid to try fine thread weaving. You might discover it's just what you've been looking for. We're going to end this episode with a gorgeous song from Straw Into Gold called "The Weaver is Handsome." I'm dedicating this one to all the weaver guys out there. Now, if you think the gal in this song is going a bit overboard, ask yourself this. What would you do for a guy who could warp your loom?
I am a young girl and my fortune is sad. I've a long time been courted by a roving young lad. He's courted me highly both by night and by day. And now for to leave me, he's going away. Some say I'll go crazy, some say I'll go mad. For the sake of the weaver, that beautiful lad, he's all of my life, he's all of my joy. If I can't have the weaver, my life I'll destroy. I'll cut off my hair and I'll dress in men's clothes, and I'll follow the weaver wherever he goes. For the weaver is handsome, and the weaver is tall, and I love the weaver the best of them all. Thank you. seashore. His words, they come to her as they often
Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. Thank you for helping make this show possible. Our segue music this episode was Hyperthread by Jeff Shields, podcast Troubadour. And our great new sample music is called Testing 123 by Stark Effect. And then, of course, The Weaver's Handsome by Straw into Gold. Thank you, musical guests, for allowing me to play your music on our show. Aside from the Straw into Gold, this music can be found on the Podsafe Music Network. For the Straw into Gold CDs, go check out Nadine Sanders' website, which I will have a link to in the show notes. That's all for this episode, so until next time, get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave.